It's so good to see everyone this morning. Indeed, we do have a very, very beautiful morning the Lord has given to us. And it's so good that we can come together and begin this week serving God and doing so together and strengthening one another. It's good to have everyone here. Good to have our visitors with us. It's very good to see Barbara Fears with us. Barbara has had just a tremendously difficult time with some ailments, some very serious ailments, and has not been able, as you know, to attend with us for some time, but she is back with us today for the first time in a long while. And so it sure is good to see you, Barbara. And wonderful to see Andrea Cannon. Glad she's able to be with us. And, of course, there are others here that it's so good to see everyone. We had a good gospel meeting with Brother Monty Hampton and appreciate very much the good work that he did and all those that helped lead in the service and helped to make that gospel meeting so good. Don't have it up there right now, but we will be putting up the address and the email address of Monty Hampton. And I know he would appreciate, I can speak from personal experience, that meeting preachers appreciate if the members do benefit from their lessons. Nothing better than maybe to receive some message, some note of thanks for that. It really means a lot and makes you feel like that you're not just doing a meeting, but really maybe helping people. And so we will put that information, that contact information for Brother Hampton up on the board. And if you would care to write him a note, I know he would really appreciate that. I love American history. I think there is so much in American history that is fascinating. It was a very perilous time for our young nation in the year 1783. An extremely perilous time. It's a time that a lot of people are probably not aware of. And you might think that it would have been anything but perilous because in 1783, well, the Revolutionary War was all but over. And the colonists had defeated the British and won independence. At least they were on the verge. It was a matter of treaties being signed. But it was a time in March of 1783 when the colonial army nearly revolted against that fledgling American government. And the reason why is because those soldiers that had fought for so many years and the officers who had led those soldiers for so many years to gain independence, they had a number of grievances against the colonial government. They had not received pay. They had been promised pay. They had not received it. They had been promised that they could go home to their families, and yet they were being forced to still stay as a standing army until the actual treaties were signed in Europe. And they wanted to go home, and they felt like that their grievances were not being heard. They felt like they were not being appreciated. They were not being treated fairly and honestly. And as a result of that, those soldiers and the officers of those soldiers began something of a mini rebellion. And they were led by an individual, Horatio Gates, who was one of the great generals under George Washington during the Revolutionary War. But Gates had always viewed himself as someone who ought to have been the commander of the army, the commander-in-chief, instead of that honor going to Washington. He was always jealous of Washington. And he was one of those who was instrumental in March of 1783 sending out an anonymous letter announcing that there would be a meeting of all of those officers in Newburgh, New York, at a little meeting hall. And that's where they would meet and decide if they shouldn't just take their standing army and go march against the government and take over and get what they deserve. Washington was against it, but they were so upset and so angry and had such a sense of injustice that even the revered George Washington couldn't keep them from going ahead and meeting on that March day. And so they met in this meeting hall on March 15th, 1783. And the meeting began, and General Gates was convening the meeting and presiding over the meeting. And all of a sudden, the doors in the back of the hall, they open up. And it's the figure of George Washington. And he walks in and walks to the front and asks if he may address this assembly of his officers. Gates could do nothing but permit him to. And Washington made a speech. And in this speech, he pleaded with these officers whom he knew so well, all of them jam-packed in this little meeting hall, he pleaded with them not to do what they were planning on doing. He said, "I understand your grievances. I share your grievances. But this is not what we fought for. We did not fight to establish a new Republican form of government only to then have an army then militarily take it over. It goes against everything that we stand for. Don't do this," he pleaded with them. "For God's sake, don't do this." And he finished his speech basically and looked out at the officers, and he could tell he hadn't moved them. He hadn't really got them to change their mind. The only thing he could think of to do at that point was to read a letter to them that one of the congressmen of the Colonial Congress had sent to him explaining why they were not able, because of a government that was almost bankrupt, to give the officers their pay as yet, and the reason why they hadn't done all that they had promised that they would do. And so Washington pulls out this letter from his vest pocket, opens it up, and starts trying to read it. And all the officers in the room saw him kind of hesitate and stumble as he tried to read this. And all of a sudden he paused, and he reached into his breast pocket and he pulled out his spectacles. Those men never knew he needed spectacles to read. They'd never seen their commander-in-chief wearing glasses. But they saw him put these reading spectacles on his nose and start to read this. And before he did, he looked up over the edge of those spectacles and he said, "Permit me, gentlemen, to use my spectacles. For you see, I have grown gray and almost blind in the service of my country." And he began to read that letter. And those rebellious officers, one by one, began to weep. They saw this man who had given so much, just like they had given. And they saw him and his character and his self-sacrifice. And Washington finished reading the letter, didn't say another word, folded it up, put it and his spectacles back in his breast pocket, and he left the meeting hall. The men wiped the tears from their eyes and they took a vote. The rebellion was over. The rebellion was over because of the character and the respect that that one man engendered in the mind of his people. May I talk with you this morning about leadership? Leadership. Let me talk with you about the two ways that people can lead. Two ways that people can compel others to follow them. One way to do that is through power. Through sheer power. Forcing the other person. Whether it be some kind of military power, whether it be some kind of threat. forcing the other person to submit their will to your own. That's one way that you can lead other people. But there's another way that you can lead other people, and that's through the power of moral suasion. And moral suasion is something that is absolutely dependent upon the moral character of the leader. And when there is a leader who himself is someone that just engenders respect, someone whom you know lives by the very principles that he's asking you to follow, someone who is selfless, someone who shows a moral kind of character that you admire, that you just want to emulate, someone whom you want to please. You want them to think highly of you because you think so highly of that leader. That kind of moral suasion, that's another way you can lead people. And I say all of that, and say that illustration of George Washington, who exemplifies this concept of leading by means of moral suasion based upon one's own character. I say all of that to talk about a leader that you and I have, who leads us not through some kind of power and force, but instead by the moral suasion of his own impeccable character. I want to talk with you this morning about the leadership of Jesus. In Philippians chapter 2, the Apostle Paul writes this about Jesus: although he existed in the form of God, he did not regard equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself, taking the form of a bondservant and being made in the likeness of men. And being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. When you think about the leader that we have, the king who rules over us, he is a king who rules over us and calls upon us to submit to his rule because of the righteousness of his own character, the rightness of his rulership over us, because of who he is, and more than that, because of that moral, humble character that he exemplifies. Paul talks here about how he existed in the very form of God, yet he did not regard equality with God as a thing to be grasped. Paul's talking about status. And status was so important in the ancient world. It's important to us in our day too. We want status. You talk about status, he was in the very form of God because that's who he was. He was God. And yet he didn't regard that, Paul says, as something to be grasped, to just be tenaciously held on to, but instead he was willing to allow his status of being in the heavenly form of God, he was willing to let it go. To empty himself, the text says. There have been a lot of theological disputes over the centuries. In the early centuries, church councils would meet and try to deal with this statement here and other statements in Scripture and talking about the nature of Jesus and the nature of his deity and becoming humanity and all sorts of theological speculation and trying to somehow fathom all of that. I think all of that kind of debating is so misguided because the point being made here is not some idea that Jesus somehow gave up his inherent godhood or something. That's not the point. He gave up being in the form of God, the status of all that, and he became something lower in the form of a man. And he says here, he emptied himself. It's a statement about his humility. We talk about somebody who's prideful. We say they're full of themselves. What's the opposite of that? Someone who's absolutely not prideful, but willing to empty themselves of what they rightfully have and possess, but willing just to empty themselves and give up. That is a statement of humility. And here Jesus was willing to not simply stay in heaven, but instead to lower himself, to take on the form of a bondservant and being made in the likeness of men. So rather than being in the form of God, he became in the form of a bondservant. Talk about a change of fortunes. And that's what Jesus willingly did. And he didn't just come to this earth and become incarnate as a great human being in this world, but instead, as Ralph so eloquently put this morning, and I could not improve upon his words, I don't have the ability to do that. Jesus, born in lowly Bethlehem, not with great pomp and circumstance and regalia, but instead as just a low peasant. And that was only the beginning of his willingness to humble himself. No, he, verse 8 says, being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. And my goodness, those words have so much meaning. And Ralph is right, we dare not just gloss over them, because we've read them 100, 200, 300 times. No, he became the basest of human beings. He suffered the kind of death that was the death of an absolute criminal, someone not even worthy to be considered part of society. What was involved in dying on a cross? Tell you what, we just have no conception. Stripped naked in front of everyone, after having been flogged, after the flesh, as Ralph pointed out, ripped from a person's body, and then having his body, his naked body being nailed to that cross, his feet nailed to that centerpiece. Not as so often the movies show where a person is just hanging there, but no, having to exert the energy and push up on those nails in one's feet to just get some air in one's lungs to even breathe, and then to come back down again and put pressure on the nails in one's hands. It was a tortuous kind of death, an agonizing, writhing kind of death, as there you are in all of your shame and indignity and humility and pain and agony, and everyone watching you as you die as this despicable human being. That's what Jesus lowered himself to become. And that is the individual who calls upon us to now serve him and follow him and do what's right and serve God the way he was trying to do what was right and serve God. That's the one who asks us to follow his lead. You know, the Old Testament prophets talked about a new covenant that was one day going to come. A new covenant not like the old Mosaic covenant that the Israelites never kept. Jeremiah 31 talks about it. Verse 31, it should read. Verse 31 says, behold, days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah, not like the covenant which I made with their fathers in the day I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt, my covenant which they broke, although I was a husband to them. But this is the covenant which I will make with the house of Israel after those days, declares the Lord. I will put my law within them, and on their heart I will write it, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. We ask the question sometimes, what's the difference between the old covenant and the new covenant? And we talk about, well, the old covenant was a covenant where sins were not forgiven and remitted only in a symbolic sense, but the new covenant sins would be remitted, and of course all that's true.
But what this passage is especially talking about is that under that new covenant, you're going to have people who will have God's law written in their heart. They're not going to be people who are rebelling against God's law like the Israelites did with the law of Moses, that old covenant. Instead, Jeremiah says that one day this new covenant would come on the scene, and it would be a covenant wherein those people would have the law of God written in their heart, and they would willingly follow it. That's the main difference being talked about here, in addition to the idea of their sins being forgiven under that new covenant. Question I want to ask us is, yes, what makes the new covenant a covenant somehow with the ability for those people following it to sincerely be following it, to be obeying it? What's different? What makes this new covenant so different that it's able to have people obeying it, unlike that Mosaic covenant where the people didn't keep it? What's different? Is it that somehow under the new covenant, God with His Spirit somehow against our will just miraculously just forces us to obey? Does He exert His power to just physically force us to stop sinning and do those things that are right? No. No, what we understand, what we can understand on this side of all this, on this side of the fulfillment of the prophecy of Jeremiah 31, is that this new covenant is a covenant where all of us voluntarily submit. Not out of coercion, not out of force of power, but we voluntarily submit. What's the difference? I want to say to you, brethren, the difference is Jesus. I think that's the point. I think that's the point that Satan never understood. I don't know what Satan thought. I don't know how much he did or didn't know about God's plan. I dare say he didn't understand until it came about through Jesus what God was doing. But Satan sure never would have imagined that all these people that he's been accusing before God as people who don't care about God and would never care about God, Satan surely never imagined that one day there would be people who would voluntarily, willingly walk down that path of righteousness no matter what difficulties it entailed. They were going to do the right thing and follow God. What is it that makes us do that? Just the moral suasion of our King. Because He's done that. Because He's made all these sacrifices. Because we look at Him and we're so overwhelmed with our appreciation of all that He has done for us. How can we not but serve Him? Romans chapter 8, I think Paul is talking about much the same thing when he says in verse 3, what the law, that is the Mosaic law, could not do, weak as it was through the flesh, God did, sending His own Son in the likeness of sinful flesh and as an offering for sin. He condemned sin in the flesh in order that the requirement of the law might be fulfilled in us. In order that the requirement of the law might be fulfilled in us. A lot of debate among interpreters as to what that expression requirement of the law means. Dikaioma is the Greek word. What exactly does it mean? And some suggest that it's talking about that requirement, that legal requirement for there to be punishment, recompense, when the law is violated, so Jesus' sacrifice provides that recompense, and so that's the requirement that the law demanded. Maybe that's involved. But the word that is used here is the word that ordinarily just means the idea of a commandment, something to be obeyed. And it seems to me that at least part of what is involved in all this is that God wasn't just wanting in His plan to somehow forgive sinners. God wanted to do more than just the mere legal act of forgiving them. God wanted them to change. God wanted people who would not be walking in sin, but would instead be fulfilling that requirement of His law. willingly, voluntarily. And that's what God accomplished through His Son. The same Son whose death provides the sacrifice to atone for sin, and yes, take the punishment for sin, the same Son whose sacrificial death does all of that, it provides that moral kind of suasion. It illustrates who He is and His character. Everything that the Apostle Paul was talking about. It's the character of our King. Everything Paul was talking about in Philippians 2, it's the character of our great King. That's what compels us. That's what God saw in His plan as the thing that could compel us. Now let me say this.
You don't have to be impressed by Jesus' character. You don't have to be impressed by Him. God isn't forcing you to. But let me tell you what. If you're not impressed by the character of Jesus, if the character of our King doesn't sway you, doesn't compel you to do the right thing, it's because you're refusing to really look at Him and really consider His character. Philippians 2, verses 6 through 8, again, I remind you of what those verses are talking about. Those verses are talking about the idea of His humility. The humility of Jesus.
What does serving God call you to do in terms of humility? Are there some things that you've got to lower yourself to do that you don't want to do, yet to serve God and be a Christian, you're being called upon to somehow lower yourself and do something you don't want to do? Is there something like that that's in your mind? Let me tell you what. What will motivate you to have the humility to go ahead and do whatever it is that you need to do, whatever sacrifice of your pride you need to make, what will motivate you to do that is to consider the humility of our King. So I'm going to tell you what. No matter what you have done in your life or will ever have to do in your life by way of humbling yourself, it isn't even remotely comparable to how our King had to humble and humiliate Himself. I've known people, they're so worried about what other people think of them and this and that and their pride. You know, I don't want to lower myself in the eyes of others. Let me tell you what. Here's Jesus stripped naked in front of everybody, being nailed to that cross. And He's God. And yet that's what He humbled Himself to. We have no room.
The character of our King, His moral purity. Let me tell you what.
The problem with us, myself included, the problem with all of us when it comes to sins in our life that we just can't seem to motivate ourselves to give up. The problem is we're not looking at Jesus. Because this King that we're serving is someone who exemplified moral purity. And it cost Him so much to have to live that morally pure life. Ralph talked about Jesus in the garden and His agony as He anticipates what He's going to have to go through. And Father, please let this cup pass from me. I have no doubt that the physical torment was part of what He was dreading. But I think also what He's dreading is the sheer responsibility of it all. Because it all rests upon His shoulders. He's got to maintain His moral character. And He did. And He did all that for you and me. He didn't gain something out of that. He gained nothing that wasn't always His. He did all that and humbled Himself and lived this morally pure life in a flesh and blood body, being tempted just like you and I are tempted. And don't ever let yourself think that somehow Jesus doesn't understand your temptations and what you go through and how difficult it is and all that. He understands exactly that. Not just because He's God and omniscient, but because He was there.
He put on flesh. He knows what the desires of the flesh are like, how strong they can be.
And what will motivate you to do the right thing is to look at Jesus. Look at the character of our King.
Look at His self-sacrifice. Look at His self-sacrifice. Are there some things that you've got to sacrifice, that you've got to give up to do what's right, to serve God?
So often we just focus in upon ourselves and our life and all the poor, pitiful me kind of things that I have to endure and all the sacrifice I have to make and this and that. Look at what He had to sacrifice. Look what He had to give up. And I tell you what, folks, when you start to think about that and look at Jesus and make yourself focus in upon Him, your heart will melt. Your heart will melt. I tell you what. You can turn away from Him. You can quit looking at Him, because you know if you keep looking at Him and keep thinking about Him and His moral purity and His self-sacrifice and His humility, it's going to sway you. And if you don't want to be swayed, you can refuse, but you'll do it by turning away from Him. That's the only way. And you'll refuse to look, and you'll shut off the ears of the preacher for whatever reason, and you'll just not think about that, and you'll think about something else, and just turn away from all that, and that's how you'll be able to still stand your ground. And I tell you what, if you look toward King Jesus, He will make your hard heart just melt. Let me give you one final passage. Philippians 2, verses 3 through 5. The immediately preceding verses of the verses we just read. Paul says, "Do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit, but with humility of mind, let each of you regard one another as more important than himself. Do not merely look out for your own personal interests, but also for the interests of others. Have this attitude in yourselves, which was also in Christ Jesus." And then Paul goes on to talk about, although He existed in the form of God, He emptied Himself, and so on. Are there some people that you're having a hard time getting along with? Because you're angry, you're mad, you're upset. Is it hard for you to regard other people as more important? You want to focus in on yourself and all the indignities that you've gone through. Hard for you to look toward other people and put their interests as more important than yours? Is that difficult for you? It's difficult for me. Is it difficult for you? Paul says, well, I'll tell you what. That attitude, the attitude that He's asking us to have, it's the attitude that Jesus Himself displayed. Have this attitude in yourselves, which also was in Christ Jesus. And I tell you what, when I'm not looking at Jesus, in my mind, when I'm not contemplating Him, when I'm turning away from Him, putting other people's interests above mine, well, it's hard to do. Not focusing in upon myself and what I want and my injustices and all these things, it's hard to do when I'm not looking at Jesus. When I'm not looking at Jesus, putting other people's interests above my own, boy, that's really tough. But I tell you what, when I look at Jesus and I see Jesus on the cross, and I see all that He went through, and Jesus hanging there and then saying, in effect, to me, "Now I want you to do what I've done, Marty. I want you to put other people's interests above your own." All these people around me, Jesus saying, "I want you to put your
put their interests above your own and humble yourself to do that, whatever it takes. When I see Jesus on the cross as the one who's asking me to do that,
it makes it a whole lot easier for me to put other people's interests above my own,
for me to humble myself and quit lamenting about all the terrible things that I have been mistreated in. And when I look at Jesus, it just makes it so much easier for me to do what's right. Can't help but do what's right. In fact, the times when I don't do what's right, I know what the real problem is. I took my eye off of Jesus. Quit thinking about him. Is there someone here this morning that needs to look at Jesus more closely, to focus your attention upon him, to really think about him, and allow the character of our King, this wonderful, wonderful King, allow that character to just soften our hearts? Is there someone here who needs to do that this morning? To make your life right with him, whatever that need might be. If there is, we sure would like to help you, whatever way that we can. Won't you come and together we stand and sing this song?